Creek Youth Development Center, Terrascope Youth Radio at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and Youth Radio from Youth Media International in Oakland, California. The views expressed on Blunt are those of the individual speakers and producers, and not those of WMPG management or the University of Southern Maine. Blunt Youth Radio welcomes opposing views.
It has to start somewhere. It has to start sometime. What better place than here? What better time than now?
What's your contribution going to be? What problems are you going to solve? What discoveries will you make?
I intend to broadcast from this ship 24 hours a day until the day I die. And then for a couple days after that.
No one's written your destiny for you. You make your own future.
I've always lived for news and weather. Happy to dive into them too. Especially the weather.
Oh, these last few weeks before school starts have been crazy.
Summer homework is always the worst part of summer.
Yeah, I'm going into AP English at Portland High, which means, among other things, I had to read A Brave New World.
That weird dystopian novel?
Well, it's not quite dystopian, but yeah, it's quite weird. It's actually really fascinating to see how people in the 1900s thought the future would turn out.
Oh, like the Jetsons. They thought the future would be Orbit City with flying cars.
Yeah, exactly.
Tonight on WMPG's Blunt Youth Radio, Chris and I will be discussing the future.
That's right, Milena. Not necessarily the future we know to be there, but the future that was once expected.
How did we change from expecting the future to be bright, happy, and spectacular to machine-dominated, pessimistic prediction?
Yeah, tonight we talked to one of Blunt's own members, Iris San Giovanni, who is at a public hearing to determine Portland's and Maine's own future.
And local Maine author of science fiction, fantasy novels, and short stories, Elizabeth Hand.
My name is Chris McCabe.
And I'm Milena German. This is Blunt Youth Radio Project, award-winning youth radio broadcasting live from WMPG every Monday night. This is a call-in show, so call in with your questions and comments at 780-4909. That's 780-4909.
We really would like to hear from you. So now, we do have Iris on the line, and we are going to be talking with her.
They're going to be now.
Yeah, Iris and Giovanni, hello. You're at the... Or somebody along the lines.
Hello.
South Portland City Council discussing tar sands at Mahoney Middle School, correct?
Hi.
Yeah. Hi.
Tonight at Mahoney Middle School in South Portland, Maine, there's a city council meeting taking place. And tonight, the future of South Portland Waterfront, the future of South Portland's economy, the health of its citizens and environment could all unfold. And are being discussed. Tonight is the second reading in a public hearing on the citizens' initiated proposed waterfront protection ordinance. And it passed its first reading on July 1st and is now given its second reading on August 8th. And the passage requires at least 5 affirmative votes. Now, to just also bear with me, If accepted by the councilors, it will become an ordinance within 15 days, but if rejected, it will go to public vote on November 5th. And right now I am with Rob Sellin, and he's the co-chair of the Citizens Initiative that wrote this ordinance. So, Rob, please tell us why you're here.
I was pleased to be with you. We're here. Probably about 500 people in the hall, not all of them supporters of the initiative. Most of them are. And we're here because this is an opportunity, perhaps a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, to keep our city free of tar sands pollution. And if we can do that through this initiative, which changes the zoning ordinance that prohibits the loading of ships with tar sands for export to India and China, we can protect the Sebago Lake watershed for all of southern Maine. We can protect our school children who go to school next to a 19-tank farm from what would become 126 million gallons of tar sands oil storage. And, of course, as they load the ship, they generate toxic fumes, and those are burned off at our beautiful Bug Light Park on the pier. So all of that will be prevented by passage of the Waterfront Protection Ordinance.
Can you give us an idea of what's happening or what it looks like there?
Hello?
Hi.
Hi.
Oh, hi.
Hey there.
So, yes. Also, I just wanted to take a moment to sort of describe the scene. We're in an auditorium at a middle school, and it's a packed house. Right now, their public discussion is being taking place. There's a line of about 50 people or more. Just a few minutes ago, they had hit 16 for speakers, and had the mayor, Tom Blake, had announced that they would only take 70 people. And I just also wanted to point out that really the future of this ordinance can really unfold in two different ways. It's definitely displayed by the crowd, which are marked distinctly by their stickers. On one side, it's protect our waterfront, clean air, clean water for all. And on the other, it is save our working waterfront. And I saw in the crowd the CEO for the Portland Pipeline, Chris Wilson.
Larry Wilson,
excuse me. So, Rob, before I let you go, what are you hoping, and how do you feel this will impact the future? What are you hoping the outcome will be?
Well, the outcome for tonight is actually pretty predictable. This will be sent to the ballot. The councilors will then vote to send it to the ballot on November 5th, and then it'll be the people against big oil. They will pull out all the stops, as they already are starting to. They will spend big, big money. And we are a citizens volunteer association, and we're going to go from door to door, talk to the citizens, explain the risks. There are only risks for us and only profits for the oil companies. These oil companies, particularly the Portland Pipeline Company, has 10 directors. 8 of them are sitting in Canada tonight. One of them is in Houston, Texas, and the other one is here at the meeting, and he doesn't live in South Portland. So that's what we're up against. It's going to be a big fight, but I think the people will prevail. And as they say, this is a chance for the people to take a place at the table, because if you don't sit at the table, you'll be on the menu.
Great. And to listeners, you can watch this discussion, this council meeting online at the South Portland government website. And again, a packed house, a variety of people, young, old, and as Rob had mentioned, as citizens have been speaking out about the health of their children, the health of the environment, also to property values. So those have all been spoken for.
Iris?
Yes.
Do you think we could know how the proposed law will work?
Yes. So the Water Protection Ordinance is to protect and ensure the welfare of South Portland, including the protection of property rights, aesthetic values, economic interests, to promote scenic views on the waterfront, and to protect the environment. And as Rob is saying, that most likely the outcome of this this meeting tonight will be the public vote on November 5th.
All right, thank you. And so the climate's future, how will that be affected? What is the future for the climate?
The future for the climate, as it's brought up by a lot of citizens, there was a local doctor who spoke out about, of course, asthma being a large concern. As far as the environment goes, the bitumen, which is a chemical used to transport this tar sand oil, leaking, and that was especially a concern with Kaler School, elementary school, being so close to oil tanks, and the fumes, of course, from the smokestacks, being just a real risk to its people of South Portland.
So there's a very large variety of things that can harm the environment from just this one.
And not only the environment, the people around it.
Well, people are part of the environment. So, Iris, thank you very much for finding all those people.
Yes.
And now we know what it's like. And so you said we could find a video of this?
Yes, this is being recorded live on the South Portland website, the government website.
Do you know the address of the website?
I do not off the top of my head, but a simple Google search would lead you there.
All right. Thank you so very much, Iris. And she has been at the South Portland Convention talking about the Waterfront Preservation Ordinance at Mahoney Middle School. Thank you very much for joining us, Iris.
No problem. Thank you.
So tonight we are also speaking, in addition, with an amazing author, a local Maine author, Elizabeth Hand. She's written multiple fantasy novels. A little short bio about her. She was born in Yonkers, New York, and she moved to Washington, D.C. to study playwriting and cultural anthropology when she was 18. When she was 31, she moved up here to coastal Maine. She writes primarily science fiction and fantasy novels and short stories. Now, Miss Hand, are you on the phone with us?
Yes, I am.
Hi.
Hello there.
Hi.
It's a pleasure to have you join us tonight.
Oh, I'm delighted. Thank you.
So, we're just going to ask you a few questions, or more than a few. But we'd love you to answer them to the best of your ability, but if you don't want to answer them, that's quite okay.
Oh, great. No, I'm sure I'll be able to I hope I'll be able to answer them. I'm certainly willing to answer them.
All right. So we're just going to ask the first question. You have many books published, both sci-fi and fantasy, but those that are looking at our future, do they reflect your views of the future?
Yes, they do. I was born in 1957, which is the same year that Sputnik, the first satellite, was sent up by the Russians, an event I don't remember, but I grew up in the 60s when the space race was going on in the U.S., which was a very, very exciting time to be a kid and interested in science fiction and in science. But by the time I was a teenager in the 70s, things had changed, and especially with the environment, your earlier guest speaking about the possible impact of environmental impact on things in Portland. And I began to develop a much darker worldview about what the future might hold. So that is reflected in probably most of my science fiction novels and stories. Not all, but I would say, predominantly.
So major world events recently, have those changed your views of the future?
Have they changed my views of the future? That's a very good question. I guess the short answer would be no, because the confluence of climate change and overpopulation and political unrest does not seem to be a very good recipe for a benign future. But I also feel that things are changing so rapidly in so many ways, with social media, with the internet, with computers, with science and scientific breakthroughs, that all of that gives me some hope. Whether or not we're going to be able to tackle all the issues that are a result of climate change, I don't know. But it does seem to me that we have the tools at hand if we can start very quickly learning how to develop them better and certainly to make use of them in ways that we're not perhaps doing right now.
That is actually a great way, both looking at pessimistic and optimistic views of what's happening today to influence the future.
Actually, I was just talking with my dad the other day, and he came up with a good question. Do you think that views on the future really just boil down to if you're a pessimist or an optimist? Like, is it going to be a great future, or is it going to turn out like a post-apocalyptic scene?
Well, that's another really good question. I think from, an early age, certainly insofar as storytelling goes, I was drawn to sort of darker subject matter, but I'm not sure I'm not sure how much of a pessimist I am. I don't know that I'm an optimist either. I guess I would like to think of myself as a realist, kind of seeing both sides of the situation. But I certainly think that having a pessimistic attitude towards any challenges we might face, you know, certainly with the environment, looking at that from a pessimistic point of view is not going to enact the kind of change that we need. So I think it's important to have a certain amount of hope and optimism, and to use that as a kind of, you know, to use that to sort of energize change, because certainly things can change. I mean, in the 1960s and 1970s, we saw a lot of social changes. We're seeing it now. You know, we're seeing changes with gay rights, with rights for women, with rights for people in different parts of the world where, you know, they were not living under a democratic government. So things can change. And I think it's important to hold on to that hope and that belief, despite the fact that every time, you know, you look at the news online or you look out the window or look at, you know, TV, you're bombarded with often very frightening images of all the bad stuff that's happening.
But you managed to look at both bright sides and the media's dark sides.
Yeah, I try to. I had a novel that came out in 1997 called Glimmering, which I had started writing about 2 years before that. So it's now, you know, it was something I started writing, say, about 18 years ago. And it was a near future novel. And essentially, the future that it, that I was projecting is sort of the world that we live in now. And there was, I basically was trying to come up with the worst possible scenario for the near future, with just all kinds of terrible things going wrong, with, you know, climate change and terrorism and viruses, killer viruses, and, you know, social unrest, and, I mean, anything you can think of. I never imagined that all of these things would actually come to pass within such a short period of time. I really didn't. I did not, you know, I just was making this stuff up. But a friend of mine who is a futurist with a think tank in D.C., he read that book, and he really liked it, but he sort of set a challenge to me because he felt that it was so dark and the ending was so dark that he felt that I'd really kind of dropped the ball. And at, you know, 15, 17 years ago, I didn't feel that way, but I feel that way now. And I actually did a revised version of the book to kind of have it end on a slightly more hopeful note, which is not something I've ever done in my life. But his comments really hit home with me how important it is, I think, to you know, to be realistic in confronting a lot of these problems, but also to try to have a can-do attitude that we really can do something about it because, we have to. Nobody else is going to. So it's really, you know, it's up to us, it's up to people my age, and, you know, it's certainly, unfortunately, going to fall into the hands of people from your generation and my kids' generation, so my kids are both in their early 20s, and, you know, you all are going to be left with the mess that you didn't necessarily make, that you have to clean up, you know, I'm not happy about that. For you, or for my kids, or for anybody else, but I do believe that that being aware and having sort of a cold-eyed awareness of the real world can actually be a very powerful tool in setting out to attempt to fix it.
Well, you said that there were a lot of problems to be left for our generation, and I'm agreeing with you, there are a lot of things for us to clean up.
Definitely.
But I also think that a lot of us are taking a very optimistic look at that. Like, this is a challenge that we can do. And a lot of us are really taking steps. Like, first part of the show, we talked to Iris San Giovanni. She's actually out at an organization. She's not much older than I am, just a year or two older than I am, and she is taking action. She's going out there trying to change the world just herself. Well, with a bunch of other friends in South Portland. But she is taking action. I think a lot of people our age are really ready to start fixing up our planet.
Well, I believe that, too. And I think that gives me more hope than anything else that I can think of in the world right now. Because, you know, I look at young people in our community, and I look at, you know, people who are, you know, friends of my kids and people they know from college, and I see how people are organizing to do things on a grassroots level and also on a, you know, on a national level as well. And I think one great advantage that you have is social media, you know, which was not something that, you know, science fiction really anticipated, you know, that people were writing about computers and, you know, the dangers of computers and the amazing things that computers would do. But I don't think anyone really anticipated how they would change the social and cultural landscape through social media. And I think that is just going to be an incredible tool to use for change, for positive change. I mean, we're already seeing that, you know, we've seen that with the Arab Spring. We're seeing that with all kinds of things on, you know, varying degrees of participation by, you know, hundreds or thousands or millions of people.
Yeah. You actually mentioned in there that a lot of sci-fi writers didn't actually expect social media, and they were writing about computers and such. And now, back there, they might have been able to think, wow, computers are going to go so far. And today, we still think that there's a long ways for computers to go. But when I try to think of new and crazy things, like computers were to 17th century people, I can't think of anything. I can think of maybe holographs. We don't really have those yet. That's flying cars. Those are all things. But there's nothing new and absolutely impossibly available to us that I can think of.
Yeah, no, yeah, I think you're right. It's very, for many science fiction writers, it's become very difficult to kind of outstrip the speed with which new technologies are developing and being implemented. I mean, it's happening so quickly. You know, things, technology like Google Glass, you know, the glasses that you can wear. And these are things that have been, you know, dealt with in science fiction movies and in books and stories, and certainly talked about by scientists. But the speed with which all of this stuff is being produced, and because it's being used and monetized as well, you know, that the corporations that are developing these technologies, they want to make money off them. So it's in their best interest to develop them as quickly as possible and get them out as quickly as possible, you know, then to bring the price point down so as many people as possible will own it. I mean, this is what happened with computers. I can remember, you know, in the 1960s and 1970s, computers were the size of a room. And I worked at the Smithsonian at the Air and Space Museum in the 1980s, and we were a very early adapter of personal computers, which by today's standards are just, you know, would be like looking at an old gigantic television. But to us, they were so, you know, they were completely modern, and they were so streamlined, and they were small. You know, that took a long time to develop. And the change, you know, the things that you're talking about now happening or not happening, everything is happening much more quickly. And I think it is difficult to try to anticipate or look over the horizon and see what comes next. I do, however, think that there's going to be things that are going to surprise us. I think there are things out there that, you know, 20 or 30 years from now or 10 years from now, you know, 5 years from now, that people are going to be, you know, scratching their heads and saying, like, oh, my God, why didn't we see that one coming? But that's, you know, one of the exciting things of being alive. It's this is, you know, the curse of living in interesting times.
Yeah.
I want to quickly interrupt just to remind our listeners that this is a call-in show for questions and comments, and the number is 780-4909, 780-4909. And right now we're talking to Elizabeth Hand, a science fiction and fantasy author who lives in Maine.
Yeah, and actually, if you would like to speak to not just us, but also our guest speaker here, you're free to do so, unless she objects.
No, not at all.
All right, excellent. So I would like to actually just quickly say that I personally am sort of afraid of all this new technology. Like, okay, there's a stereotype for young people being, oh, this is so cool, I'm going to go out and get it immediately. But then I look at the Google Glass, and it just sort of scares me. Like, there's so much that's available to that.
Yeah, I think it's... I think it's intimidating, not personally intimidating, that I feel like, oh, I couldn't handle using that or something, although I don't know if I could, but what I find somewhat, not necessarily alarming, but something that maybe we should have some concern about is, again, how quickly these things are being developed and put out there, and we are not having a chance to really learn about the impact they're going to have on our culture, you know, on our society. You know, the way that when the automobiles were introduced, it completely transformed the landscape of our country. Well, you know, transformed everything. But, you know, there were no science fiction writers or anybody else at that time who was looking ahead and, you know, everybody thought the automobile was this wonderful thing, a horseless carriage. Nobody saw the creation of the interstate system. Nobody saw the impact that using fossil fuels is going to have. Nobody saw the fact that there were going to be all of these other industries that had been well established that were going to disappear as the automobile became, you know, the accepted mode of transportation. And we're seeing things like that happen right now. I mean, it's something, you know, certainly something I'm very familiar with is the publishing industry. The internet and digital technology and digital publishing have put a huge number of people out of work and have done away with huge segments of, you know, the news industry, newspapers, old-fashioned print publishers.
It is all in all sort of unfortunate, but yeah, I'm just going to have to cut you off just a second. Sorry, sure. We do have a caller. Robert from Harpswell. Are you there with us?
Yes, thank you. I hate to say this, but I kind of disagree with what the author's saying. I grew up in the 70s and 60s, and the mobilization of the youth was the mobilization of the youth. I don't see that today on the massive level that it was then. Also, the educational system in this country is not very good in terms of encouraging students to be critical thinkers. And with money in politics and the United States taking the lead in the world and the suppression of journalists, I don't see where this great change is going to happen. I mean, I'm never a pessimist. I'm more of a realist, and I hate to say it, but I am not as optimistic as you are. Look at and then I'll end on this. What's happening in Egypt, if we were basically advanced as you kind of say we are, there'd be a lot of support for the people in Egypt, a lot of support for the revolutionary movement there. But the United States press and government tends to splinter things, and we don't have a global movement for change.
All right. Well, thank you for your opinion.
Okay. I'll hang up and just hear what's said.
Yeah, right, thank you, Robert.
So, yeah, that is quite a bit to discuss.
Yeah, and I think, you know, he's right in a lot of ways. He does, you know, he has a lot of valid points. And he's correct about a lot of things. I don't know that I agree with him about the educational system, you know, at least not 100%. Both of my kids went to school in Maine and got very good educations, and, you know, and they went to public school. But I think we don't see I think he's correct in that we don't see the sort of mobilization on the ground in this country that we saw in the 60s and 70s. And I mean, I was there. I came of age at that time as well. And I think that is something that is missing that I personally would like to see more of.
I would like to see more of it as well. Now we're going to actually continue discussing this, but I'm afraid we're going to have to go to break first. So Miss Elizabeth Hand, amazing author of Maine, if you could just stay with us over this short break, we'll be back to the show shortly.
Okay, thank you.
You're listening to WMPG and W281AC, Gorham, Portland.
And now the weather. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low around 62. West winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tuesday, mostly sunny with a high near 82. West winds 5 to 10 miles per hour, becoming south in the afternoon. Tuesday night, patchy fog after 2 a.m. Otherwise, mostly clear with a low around 62. West winds around 5 miles per hour. And Wednesday, patchy fog before 7 a.m. Otherwise, sunny with a high near 83. Light and variable winds becoming south, 5 to 10 miles per hour in the afternoon.
And we're back on WMPG, Blunt Youth Radio, talking with Elizabeth Hand, sci-fi and fantasy author living in Maine. I'm Leah Germon.
I'm Chris McCabe.
We want to remind our listeners that this is a call-in show for any questions, comments, or stories. The number is 780-4909, 780-4909.
So now we're going to go ahead and ask a few more questions to Miss Elizabeth Hand.
Elizabeth, are you there?
Yeah. You know, I'm here. I'm hanging on to your every word.
Awesome. All right.
Fantastic.
So our first question is a bit of a big question. Do you think science fiction is politically related? I mean, you sort of answered this at the beginning, but how politically influenced is our view of the future and past views of the future?
Well, I think a lot of science fiction is very politically related. Not all of it. I think some of it is, you know, what you might call old-fashioned space opera that's, you know, more just for sheer entertainment. But even that, I think, has not necessarily a political subtext, but certainly a cultural one. You know, as somebody who has a background in cultural anthropology, that there's no way that, you know, you can write a book that is not going to be, even a novel about the far future, that is not, to a large extent, going to be informed by the way we live now and by, you know, the milieu that you as a writer grew up in and out of. So, yeah, there are many novels that have sort of a science fictional, science fiction novels that have a political basis, and certainly some of the most well-known, you know, now classic books from the 1970s, like Ursula Le Guin's The Dispossessed, or another novel of hers, The Left Hand of Darkness, which dealt with, one is a very sort of utopian novel about a non-capitalist society on a planet, and the other one is a book about gender politics that's set on another planet. So she certainly made good use of political and cultural information to kind of create a new, literally a new world that she wrote about. More recently, I'm thinking of writers like Neal Stephenson, who had a great book out a couple of years ago called, I don't know how you pronounce it, Reamde, R-E-A-M-D-E is how it's spelled. And that was a great book that dealt with, you know, all kinds of political, situations, all kind of thrown together, and a very, very entertaining book as well. William Gibson's books, are very much informed by contemporary politics. And certain, you know, I don't think these are books that necessarily take a stand insofar as they, you know, that it is that you have a writer there who's writing something as a polemic. But I think the books are certainly informed by those authors, you know, their beliefs.
Oh, yeah. So, like, real locations end up influencing people and things that are happening in their era. And...
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, there's no way around it. Science fiction from other countries, I think historically and perhaps now as well, tended to be less optimistic than American SF. American science fiction from, you know, the early part of the 20th century, you know, the 1920s on, was very much informed by this kind of, you know, you go, America, ethic. Of success, and you're going to conquer the world, and, you know, then you're going to go out and you're going to conquer the universe. And it was, in a very simplistic way, it was very much kind of a lot of sort of imperialist attitudes, certainly a lot of very masculine attitudes that sometimes were misogynist, and sometimes at their best just ignored the existence of women.
I feel like this was in part to the world wars that were going on in that era, like the early 1900s. So I know that the world wars often inspired, oh, what patriotism, we're going to defeat the villains and all that. So that probably influenced a lot of science fiction.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. It did. And it also, you know, there was a lot of fear of the other. You know, a lot of fear of the outsider. And so that, of course, then got projected into the ultimate outsiders who were, you know, aliens, people from outer space, people who needed to be conquered or perhaps, you know, coerced or in some instances befriended. But they were beings that were different from us. And I think that was also an anxiety that, yes, you're absolutely right, that writers picked up on from wartime.
I actually have a little question on there. The word alien itself, we use it to both describe foreigners and little green people from outer space, or whatever color they may be. I don't mean to judge. but do you know why we use alien for both of those? Is it just for reasons that they're foreign to us?
That's a good question, too. I'm not sure. Let me get my handy-dandy Oxford Dictionary here to just see what I want to just look the word up, because that's, I don't really know. I've never actually gone to look it up. Let's see. Alien means not one's own. Oh. Foreign, under foreign allegiance, differing in nature from something, out of harmony, repugnant, non-naturalized foreigner, a being from another world, a person excluded. So it's from the Latin, belonging to another.
Okay.
Alienus, alias. So, yeah, so it looks like it was, I guess it was just picked up, science fiction writers just must have picked it up and sort of projected it as the most extreme kind of other that you could imagine was, you know, the bug-eyed monster from Alpha Centauri.
Yeah, well, that actually makes me a little curious. Like, when did they first think that there were people in outer space? Was it way back in ancient Greece when they looked up at the stars and the philosophers just thought, maybe there's somebody out looking down at me? Or was it during the time of the space race? Oh, maybe there's somebody on the moon. Oh, wouldn't that be weird?
Oh, I think I'm sure if you were to go and look at the, you know, science fiction encyclopedia online or some other source that would have historical information for that. I'm sure that there were aliens or other creatures living on other planets that people were thinking about that and in some instances writing about it. Somebody, I can't now recall who, but I think somebody from maybe the 16th century, 17th century, did write about, you know, a journey to the moon. you know, not a real journey, but, you know, a story, a fairy tale. And, I mean, I can't, I guess some of, I guess some of that would just be sort of predicated on at what point did people look at the stars and realize that they were, you know, something else out there, that they were, you know, heavenly bodies, that they were planets, that they were, you know, suns, that were all these other things and not just a decoration in the sky. And I don't know at what point that happened. You know, probably somebody out there does. Maybe there's a listener who does. But I would say that at whatever that point was, whether it was hundreds of years ago or 1,000 years ago or thousands of years ago, I would say that would be the point. As soon as you recognize a place that's distant and sort of out of reach, I think one of the first things that people do is start imagining who or what might live there. And then the next thing they seem to start imagining is what it would be like to live there themselves. So, you know, this is one of the impulses behind, you know, people exploring. Hundreds of years ago when Western European explorers were going out and looking for the quote-unquote New World, or people in, you know, Micronesia getting in their boats and going somewhere else. You know, they saw something on the horizon and they thought, oh, let's go see what's there. Let's go see who's there. And I suspect something similar went on when, you know, somebody looked up at the sky and thought, I wonder who's out there.
That does seem to be a genuinely human trait.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm just wondering what's out in the great yonder, sailing across oceans or flying to stars.
Yeah. Did you happen to see the meteor shower last week?
I did.
I did not get to see it. I saw pictures of it, if that counts.
That counts. I only saw two not very big meteors, so.
I saw a couple on the beach. It was really inspirational, actually,
just
wonder if it was out, if anything else was out there.
So you saw a lot of the shooting stars?
Yes, I was on Kettle Cove Beach when it happened.
Oh, that's great.
Just lying there, and it was very, very dark, clear sky. It was very easy to mistake satellites going versus the actual meteors themselves, but we did see quite a few. It was very, very inspiring.
Yeah, it is. I went out just for a little while. I put a blanket out in a field behind my house and just kind of lay down there and looked at the sky. And I find it very hard to look at the stars and not think that there is something else out there. When you think of how many billions of, you know, stars and planets there are, the odds of us being the only one, that just, those seem like really bad, you know, they don't seem like good odds.
Yeah.
I hope whatever is out there that they're relatively forgiving.
Yeah, no, I do actually.
When they ever come here.
I just want to do two things. First, I'm just going to remind listeners that this is a call-in show, and you can call at 780-4909. Again, 780-4909. If you wish to call in and talk to us, we only have 15 minutes left with Milena and myself, Chris, and our amazing guest tonight, Miss Elizabeth Hand. So now I'm actually going to go on and say that, well, I often just think of the universe, so supposedly the universe is infinite and it's infinitely expanding, and I'm pretty sure that scientists actually have a secure way to say that and aren't just trying to fool us. But if there's an infinite number of stars out there, because there's an infinite number of space, there could be an infinite number of stars, an infinite number of planets orbiting those stars. And so out of an infinite number of possibilities, the chance that humanity is the only race out there is very slim.
Yeah, yeah. So that's what I agree completely.
That's just one way I see it. So we're actually going to have to say goodbye pretty soon to Miss Elizabeth Hand. If there's anything you particularly want to say, just
last-minute comments or topics?
Well, if you're asking me, I guess what I would say in closing is that I find this very inspirational to listen to both of you and, you know, and Blunt Radio, and to know that there are people out there like you who are so engaged with the community and so engaged with ideas and with outreach and sharing information. And I find that incredibly inspirational, and that really does, that gives me a great amount of hope.
I like to do Blunt Youth Radio primarily because, well, yeah, sure, it's fun, but I also get to speak to great people, like science fiction authors. I never get to speak to them. Like, I just read their stories, but I never actually get to hear them speak and hear how they see the world. So this is a great opportunity to meet amazing people as well.
Well, thank you for letting me be part of it. It's really, I think it's great.
Thank you so very much for joining us tonight.
Oh, you're so welcome.
You have a nice night.
Thanks, you too.
Thank you. So, that was an amazing guest, being able to hear from somebody who writes their own stories. I mean, I just usually read these stories or boring other things.
Then you wonder what's going through your head when you're writing them, and we got to find out tonight.
It was amazing. I mean, we still have 12 minutes, but we are actually going to talk to another person. Well, not another person, the same person we talked to in the first half of the show, if you were listening for that. Her name is Iris Sangiovanni. We're not going to talk to her just yet, but pretty soon. We're just going to mention something really quickly beforehand, what she's doing there. So, she's probably also going to say, but tar sands is the issue she's currently addressing in South Portland. And tar sands have been an issue recently as we are running out of natural oil. Tar sands is often found in Alberta, Canada, and actually all over Canada. But so, now I do believe that Iris is on the phone. Iris Sangiovanni, are you
Iris
there?
Iris, right there.
Hello, hi.
Hey there.
Yes, again, I'm at Mahoney Middle School in South Portland, Maine. We're at a city council meeting that's discussing the water protection ordinance. And I am here with Jim Merrill, who is the spokesman for the Maine Energy Marketers Association. So, Jim, just please tell us why you're here and what you hope the outcome will be.
Well, I'm here this evening as a spokesman for the Maine Energy Marketers Association, and we're here tonight to send a strong industry message that the Waterfront Protection Ordinance is drafted, is overly broad, it's poorly written, and if passed, it would devastate the working waterfront of South Portland, costing the South Portland economy, jobs, tax revenue, and causing significant problems. So that's what we're here to talk about this evening.
Well, I actually have a question. How is it poorly written?
And how will the outcome... You know? So right now it seems that both sides, again, the ordinance would pass right away if the councillors, at least five, with an affirmative vote, would pass right away in 15 days. But if it doesn't, it would be going to the polls. And it seems that both sides are wanting that. How do you think the outcome of that will impact the future?
Well, there seems to be strong support in the room this evening by both sides to send this matter to the voters and let them decide. You know, the proponents of the WPO have kind of had a free run so far, and they've made a number of allegations this evening that are misleading and false, and a lot of folks are scared. So we're looking forward to taking this to the voters in November if we have the opportunity, and to educating the citizens of South Portland about how dramatically overbroad this ordinance is and the significant problems it'll cause South Portland and our working waterfront that's been here for decades working to create good jobs for working families. So we're looking forward to taking that message to South Portland between now and November.
And just to give you an update of what the scene looks like, it's, you know, about 8:15, and the auditorium is definitely emptied out, although there's at least, you know, 16 people still in line to speak. A lot are employees of the Portland Pipeline. So again, you know, both sides have been, you know, well supported. And I want to thank you, Jim, again for speaking with us.
Iris.
Iris, hello.
Yes, hi.
Do you think you could actually grab Jim before he runs away?
Oh, hold on, Jim. Jim, 1 second.
Oh, literally. All right.
He actually was going.
One second. Hold on. The host has something. Go ahead.
All right. We'd actually like to ask you, because you mentioned at the beginning that the ordinance
Hold on. I'm going to get him on the phone so he can hear this question.
All right. Thank you.
Sure, go ahead.
All right, hey, Jim. You mentioned earlier that the ordinance was poorly written. Could you explain how?
Well, I can, because this is an ordinance that the proponents have talked about, you know, going after, you know, a concern about tar sands. What they've done is they've written an ordinance that members of industry from all over are telling that it would put them out of business. So we've heard a lot of testimony tonight about how this is about tar sands. The truth is, you have businesses all over the working waterfront who are saying if this passes the way it's written, it will effectively prevent them from doing business. It has nothing to do with tar sands, but that's what everyone seems to be talking about. I don't think the ordinance proponents intended to put the entire working waterfront of South Portland out of business, but that's what it'll do.
Oh, well, that would actually be poorly written, it would seem. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
For answering that.
Thank you again.
Hello?
Hi, Iris. So I'm just actually going to ask you a few questions now, if you don't mind.
Yes, go ahead.
All right, so when you look around, which group appears to be more in number? The pro ordinance or con-agonist, anti-agonist ordinance?
Now it's a bit emptied, but I would definitely have to say there's a lot more citizens wearing the, you know, protect our waterfront, clean air, clean water, which is for the water protection ordinance. And it is interesting to look into the crowd. I mean, there is definitely a variety of people, but again, it is kind of distinct of who is for what side. And again, those against the water protection ordinance are wearing the Save Our Working Waterfront, and a lot of them are wearing suits, as they are employees of, you know, Portland Pipelines.
Iris, you still there?
Yes.
Hi. But yes, there is. I want to agree that there is strength in numbers, but is one side more motivated than the other? Like, is one more passionate or energized, or is it pretty much neutral?
It's hard to say, because, again, a lot of people are leaving, and those left in line are of the, you know, associated with the Portland Pipelines and oil and, you know, the waterfront companies. So perhaps one would say they are more motivated waiting in the line. But earlier this evening, I did see a gentleman who had created a homemade wind turbine saying, yes, yes, yes. And on the bottom of this turbine was a plastic tube that said no, 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 as to be against the tar sands. So, you know, I would say, you know, both sides are pretty well represented. It was actually interesting. The police were here. It was interesting for me to see, because I couldn't necessarily imagine any violence, you know, happening.
Mm-hmm. So we actually spoke with Jim just a minute ago and asked him how the ordinance was poorly written.
Did people address that it was poorly written? Were there other people besides Jim saying it out loud that they felt it was?
Well, I know I had spoke to a woman who had, you know, worked with the committee to write the ordinance, and one of the things that she had said, because, I mean, both sides are looking for this to take polls and for voters to decide, because if the ordinance is accepted tonight, it could then, like, the councilors could then sort of rework the ordinance. So that was one of the worries of the, you know, citizens' initiative.
Well, actually, also, Jim did say that it was likely to cut jobs, and, well, it probably would if it's going to shut down some things. But was that addressed? Did anybody speak up against that, saying that, no, not that many jobs would be canceled, or was there any rebuttal to that?
Digging through my mind, there have been a lot of speakers tonight, and the interesting thing is a lot of them are saying essentially the same thing, but all coming from different angles, different perspectives. As far as losing jobs, I don't per se think that has been addressed, but there's definitely been a huge emphasis on the health of the children and citizens of South Portland, the health of the environment, the waters around South Portland, and And as far as the economy, there was a local realtor that had spoke about property values rise or lowering, because of these smokestacks, just really, driving away potential buyers.
So the economy would actually not be hurt by this ordinance by putting people out of jobs, but it could also be helped by raising land value.
Per se, yes.
All right, that's actually pretty great. And just quickly to wrap this up, why are people worried about tar sands?
People are worried about tar sands for so many different reasons, all really because they are just very harmful to the human body, to the air, the water around us. And I do want to say one thing, that it has been sort of inspiring to see this all lay out in front of me because, this is a citizen's initiative, like the ordinance. And so it just shows that if you are really concerned about an issue, you can take action and, you can in some ways control your future and the future of others around you by, taking action.
Yeah, it's actually great. So thank you, Iris, for actually being in this amazing location, being able to talk to all these people and get them on the air and speak to us.
Oh, no problem. It was worth it all. It's been extremely exciting, and I'm glad to do it.
I actually have one more quick question. Unless, Milena, do you want to say something first?
No, I'm all good.
Okay, well, how soon exactly, just remind our listeners, how soon is this ordinance going to be voted on?
By the end of this evening, hopefully. We're at Mahoney Middle School in South Portland, and the counselors will take a vote, and it just needs 5 affirmative votes to become an ordinance within the next 15 days. But if it is turned down, it would then go to a public poll.
All right, thank
you. Thank you, Iris.
Thank you so very much for joining us tonight, Iris.
No problem.
It's been
a pleasure.
And
again, you can access this meeting online.
All right.
Are there?
Yeah, no, thank you very much, Iris. And that is actually going to be the end of our show for tonight.
All right.
This has been Blunt Youth Radio on WMPG. We'd like to thank everyone. First, I'd like to thank my co-host, Milena.
Thank you, Chris.
And we also have a few other important people to us that we'd like to thank, including our engineers tonight, Leo Hilton, Anthony Lewis, and Matt Osman. And, of course, our director for tonight, Claire Holman, as she is every night. And we'd like to thank our two primary guests, Miss Elizabeth Hand and Iris San Giovanni. And also thank you to our person who called in. We would have loved to have more people call in, but that's okay. You always have more shows that you can call in and talk to. So thank you very much.
I'm Leandra Mon.
And I'm Chris McCabe.
Have a great evening.